Welcome to Northwestern Intersections, a Northwestern Network podcast where we talk to alumni about their careers. We'll hear what they've done right, what they've done wrong, and the stories behind both. I'm Cassie Potosky with the Northwestern Alumni Association Career Advancement Team. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Alexandra Solomon, who is a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern and a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Northwestern. Dr. Solomon is the author of the best-selling book, Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to Help You Get the Love You Want, and she is the professor for the undergraduate course, Building Loving and Lasting Relationships, Marriage 101. Alexandra, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, and we're so excited to hear all about what you're doing now with the Family Institute and your book and your work as a professor. But first, we'd love to hear what your first job was.
Let's see. My first job was at a restaurant in my hometown called Big Boy in Detroit, Michigan. Oh. And I was a hostess and it was a summer job, and no, that's not true. I was a camp counselor before I was a waitress. I spent time, I was a camp counselor and a waitress, and that was basically, those were the jobs that I had high school and college.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you're from Michigan? I'm from Ann Arbor.
Oh, that was where I went to college. So yeah. When University of Michigan plays Northwestern every fall, people in my life say, who are you going to root for? And my heart is in both of those spaces always. So
it's a win-win.
It's a win-win.
I love it. And so what was your first job after graduating from college?
Well, so I went right from college to the doctoral program in counseling psychology here at Northwestern. And I have never left. They would have a difficult time getting rid of me. So in terms of jobs, I have been just dyed in purple from the time that I was a graduate student. And I have been at the Family Institute at Northwestern University for my whole career. It has been a space that has allowed me to cultivate a lot of different aspects of myself and my work. And it's been, a space that has really worked well for a long time.
And so when you first came to Northwestern as a graduate student, what was your vision for your career at that point? And why did you want to get that degree?
So I started college as a pre-med student, and I knew I would major in psychology. I'll never forget, I remember sitting in the dorm freshman year with my academic advisor, and he was encouraging me to really open myself to a circuitous path and keep my options open and to not, and it was like Charlie Brown's teacher, wah-wah, because in my mind, I was at University of Michigan in order to go to medical school. It was nothing more than a means to an end until I took a gender studies class my sophomore year. And I got pretty confused pretty quickly because I became fascinated by the space between people and the space between an individual and their culture. And it was confusing because I thought, well, I love this. I love the study of self, the study of how we make sense of cultural messages, how we grow up conditioned and push against conditioning. And so it didn't take me very long to kind of redirect from focus on medical school to knowing that I wanted to become a clinical psychologist.
Wow. And so to become a clinical psychologist, the PhD was the natural route? Or
yes.
How did you go through that decision process?
Yeah, the PhD was a natural route. I think part of my awareness was what was drawing me to medicine from the time I was a kindergartner was being able to work with people. I knew that what I would really want from my career was being in service of people, connecting with people, working with and for people. So it just was going to be a different aspect that I'd be working with rather than working with, as my mom always says, rather than working with people's bodies, you decided you wanted to work with their minds. it really is probably an accurate capturing of it. So knowing that I wanted to move towards therapy was a big piece of it. But then I also became super curious about scholarly work and writing and academia. So pursuing doctoral work where I could explore how research and scholarship and clinical work all fit together and inform each other became the path that really felt right to me. So looking at doctoral programs right off the bat from college, felt like the right next step.
Yeah. And I'd love to dive into how you had the self-awareness and the self-reflection to realize that you were really passionate about working with people and shifting gears to a different career than what you thought. Because I feel like I've been hosting webinars and talking to people who are struggling with figuring out exactly what they truly enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And how long did it take you to figure out, okay, I am going to shift gears because mm-hmm. it sounds like you were really dead set on one thing and changing your career path completely and now loving it. How long did that take?
Well, I don't think it took very long. And here's what I think. So as, you know, now that I am sort of a midlife career person and I spend a ton of time, it's interesting. I have sort of like two populations that I spend my time with. So when I'm in my clinical practice, I am by and large working with couples who are in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. But then I come to, and that practice is in the northern suburbs of Chicago. The Family Institute has a branch satellite location up there, and it works really well for me and for my life. But then, you know, several times a week I head to Evanston, and there I'm interfacing with the generation beneath me, right? The generation up and coming, millennials, and now our college students are technically Gen Z, you know? Uh-huh. And one of the pieces I think, and I do a lot of the teaching and presenting that I do out to the world, to clinicians and to the general public, is translating and trying to make sense of millennial life and Gen Z life and sort of what are the challenges and complexities that they are facing, specifically around their relationships. But in general, one of the things we talk about is I think the younger generation struggles with a deeper fear of making the wrong choice and a fear that I have to get it all figured out before I step in. And that's what their love lives around, this idea of like, I have to know they're the right person before I open my heart. And it's also, I see it with their careers, like I have to know it's the right career before I make a step forward. And that just simply wasn't a thing I struggled with. Like, I just think I was like, this seems cool, let me go for it. And there's a way in which that's a kind of resilience that I spend a lot of time wanting to support in younger generations, because it's what combats anxiety and fear of getting it wrong. This belief to your core that there are no mistakes. There's only the next thing you do with the degree of awareness that you have at that time. And really, the vast majority of us have several careers. What yeah. we do at age 25 is very rarely what we do at 45 and rarely what we do at 65. And as we get older, we can look back and we can see, oh, I get how that piece fit with that piece and threaded through to this piece. But at the time, to expect that kind of continuity is too much. At the worst, it becomes paralyzing. It yeah. becomes something where we're afraid to do anything because we're afraid of getting it wrong. And so very often I sit with college students and graduate students who come to me and we get to have these amazing conversations about career and life and the path forward. And I feel like if I thought about all those conversations, a big theme would be my desire to give them permission to just try and know that you can shift and change as you go. Mm-hmm. One way that this showed up for me is by the end of college, the kind of psychology I was interested in was feminist psychology. And so the things I wanted to study were ways in which gender and sexism affects women's mental health. So I wanted to study body image and interpersonal violence. And those were the things that I was really passionate about. And when I applied for graduate school, that was how I was presenting myself. Mm-hmm. So I get into Northwestern's counseling psychology program, and pretty early on, it becomes clear that I need to kind of figure out how I'm going to fund my academic endeavors mm-hmm. for the coming years, and there's an opportunity at the Family Institute. And my story about places like the Family Institute and the study of love and marriage was that somehow it was, I had these stories in my head about that was kind of, it was a little weak, a little silly, a little trite. It wasn't like the real stuff. Like the real stuff was like deconstructing the patriarchy. Like that was what, you know, uh-huh. that was all I was interested in. I went to the Family Institute and did this interview and started to see how the study of love, the study of intimacy, the study of partnership fascinated me. And in fact, captured lots of elements of my feminism, of my identity, of my curiosity. And so I wouldn't have known if you had talked to senior year of college me, mm-hmm. she would have been like, heck no, you're not going to become a couples therapist. So just doing the best I could ended up taking me to places that perhaps I wouldn't have gone had I felt like I needed to have a really super clear definition
right.
before I did anything.
And you had a plan, but then you adjusted it because you realized, oh, I'm super interested in this. Mm-hmm. So that trial and error kind of worked for you. Or and actually just try,
right,
really.
Right. And the pragmatics of like, I need to figure out how to fund this education. Right. This is an opportunity that maybe I can figure out how to position myself for it.
Yeah.
So there's like pragmatics and there's passion and sometimes those things, you know,
and how
sink.
It all comes together. Mm-hmm. In the study of relationships, how have you seen personal relationships impact people's careers or their professional lives? Because it's so intertwined and you can't leave something at home. Can you talk us through maybe like how the different generations are dealing with personal relationships and letting that impact their professional lives?
Yes. I, gosh, That's a great question, and it is such a developmental question because it takes different forms over time. I often frame it as these are sort of like the three conversations that we have throughout our lives. There's the conversation of, right, the conversation we all have with ourselves about, like, who have I been? Who am I? Who do I want to be? Then there's the conversation that we have in our romantic relationships of who have we been? Who are we? And who are we going to become? Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of the conversation we have with our professional self. So these are all the conversations in our best moments. They all flow and they inform each other, and each of those conversations enhances the other conversation. So that our marriage helps us be courageous in our careers, and our careers strengthen and amplify who we are as an individual. That's in the best case scenario. And then there are totally times when it feels like they are butting heads, and what mm-hmm. the marriage needs crashes right into what the career needs, or what the self is craving crashes into the realities of having to put food on the table. You know, those are lifelong conversations. So I teach an undergraduate course here at Northwestern University called Building Loving and Lasting Relationships, Marriage 101. Mm-hmm.
And which is widely popular. Everybody loves it. I've talked to many students who've gone through your course who just absolutely have great things to say. So
my darkest days are the beginning of February, when course registration fills in an instant, and then the wait list fills in another instant. And I get emails from our students that are just so heartfelt about how much they have heard about the class and wanting to be in the class. And so it is delightful when I'm able to make space for lots and lots of our students. And it's heartbreaking when I'm not able to make enough space, which mm-hmm. was a big part of why I wrote the book that I wrote, was to just make sure that there are lots of ways for people to get the lessons and the information and the process that we use in that class.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say about it is I teach graduating seniors, and so my office hours very often include conversations about, gosh, I am really in love with this person, and I'm heading off to D.C., and they're heading off to L.A., or I'm heading off to do Teach for America, and they're heading off to Peace Corps. Like, there's such amazing and extraordinary things that our students do that lead them to all different places, and that can feel very much like it bumps up against really cool romantic relationships that they have been fostering and cultivating. And there aren't any easy answers, but I do feel like what I'm able to kind of offer is just inviting them to not judge themselves for wanting to invest in love. Because I think when you are extraordinary and you're high achieving and the world is at your feet, it can feel like career success is the most important and only thing. And so I just invite our students to just make space for love, and to know that taking a detour in order to see where love goes, it's like a dead end. It's not a bad, wrong, weak, foolish choice. Because I think very often that's sort of the message in our culture, is that achievement is number one and everything else has to follow behind that. I support our students pushing back against that notion, or just expanding it, or just wondering ways in which that story serves and ways in which that story maybe constrains.
Yeah. Just knowing the student and alumni population at Northwestern are so driven, which has been really fun to have those career conversations with alumni. But we're all people, and we have lives at work and beyond, and how they all intertwine is so important. And I feel like this advice for our Northwestern network about not judging themselves for investing in love is such an important message, because, like you said, there are certain messages we get from society that make us feel guilty for that, mm-hmm. making a move potentially. You know, mm-hmm. I've talked to some other alumni on the podcast who made a move to be in their relationship. You know, that impacted their career.
One thing that I can fall back on is the research, and the research is mm-hmm. really clear. Two pieces that I often cite, one is the Valiant Harvard longitudinal study of 75 years of studying. They were all close to 300 white men, and the study is now being replicated with people of color and with women. But that initial data set, what they were tracking over the life course were these variables: health and career and money and family. And the bottom line of all of this data was that there are two pillars of happiness. One is love, and the other is living a life that does not push love away. I love that. I just think it's so compelling, this idea that the quality of our relationships really dictates the quality of our lives. And there's lots of other science that backs up that our happiness, especially in our intimate relationships, casts a really large glow on the rest of our lives, even bigger than career and money and things like that.
it seems like you have so many amazing insights about relationships and love and all of this. How has your work and your research on love and relationships impacted your career?
Well, I mean, one thing is I'm never bored. I love the work that I do. I remain enthusiastic. Being a faculty member and a clinician and a writer and a speaker means that I have to always be reading and growing and listening to other people and figuring out how the science and other people's perspectives, like how it all fits together and how I use that to further and stay fresh in the classroom, in my therapy office. So I think as somebody who has from the time I was like 3 feet tall, been like a total nerd, I think it's like a great career for me because I have to stay nerdy in order to stay competent and prepared and relevant and helpful.
No, that's great. And I know you recently wrote your book, Loving Bravely. What's been some of the feedback you've received from people who have read your book? I'm curious because you obviously have had such a large impact on so many students. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, you know, people out there beyond school.
That's been really fun. And it was a part that I don't think I anticipated. Like, I've always really appreciated the ability to translate what researchers and scholars and clinicians do to the general public. So to me, writing a book that's in the relationship self-help genre just felt like a super intuitive next step. That was the audience I wanted to write for, would be just sort of general people in relationships, people who are curious about relationships. So the book felt like it was just the perfect expression of what I like doing. So that was the piece I was focused on. What I wasn't focused on was what it would be like to hear from readers and how incredibly intimate that is, to hear stories of people realizing the shifts that they have been able to make because of the work of the book. It's just super duper humbling and something I didn't do it for that reason, but my gosh, that's really neat to be able to have people loop back to me and talk about what the book has meant to them and has opened up for them. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have any of those stories really stuck out to you, how it specifically impacted their relationships or love lives?
Okay, so two that popped to mind. One was a gal in her 40s or 50s who was pretty recently divorced and pretty ambivalent about whether and when and how she would step back out into the dating world. And she shared with me that the biggest thing she got from the book was permission, like permission to want to love again and to be loved again. And that she had been feeling guilty about that and feeling like it meant something about she wasn't a strong enough person to stand on her own 2 feet. Or she had these stories of shame for wanting to love and be loved again. And so she felt like Loving Bravely left her with a sense of permission that it was okay to want to be in a relationship again.
Yeah.
So that was cool.
That's really cool.
The other story I think of, it's something I tell often, is a gal in her 20s was in one of these situationships, sort of like booty call relationships, you know, like a not well-defined boundary and sort of see you when I see you. She was in one of these relationships with a guy. And it was late at night and he texted her and it was sort of like a, hey, let's hook up text. And she was aware that historically when he would do that, she wouldn't even think twice. She would just respond. Like that was just the pattern. Like he would reach out and she would go for it. And so he reaches out with his text. She picks up her phone to look at it. And out of the corner of her eye, she sees her copy of Loving Bravely.
It's a sign.
And one of the lessons in the book is practicing a pause. When something comes in from the outside world, pausing, checking in with yourself, and really like getting clear, is this a heartfelt big yes or is this a no? And so she checked in with herself and she was like, you know what? I actually do not feel like leaving my apartment right now and seeing this guy and having this experience again. So she said no, and she felt really clear that it was that the book, again, sort of gave her permission to break a pattern that was not working for her as well as maybe she thought that it was.
Yeah, super interesting how your book has affected so many lives out there. And I'm sure your clinical work has as well, because you do clinical therapy with a very different population of people from your work as a professor. What are some of the similarities and differences from those two generations in your work in relationships?
Right, because it is, and sometimes the paths cross, because sometimes I do therapy with younger people, and sometimes mm-hmm. I teach older people, you know, when I do
very
workshops
true.
Out in the world. But well, I love it. For one thing, I think it makes more compassionate because very often my couples have kids who are the age of my students. So I feel like I can sort of bridge those worlds a little bit and offer them some perspective on youth culture. But then I feel like sometimes my students, I can offer them some perspective on what their parents and older generation in their family may be feeling and perceiving. And so I've been doing a lot of speaking and writing lately about intergenerational love dialogues, this idea of opening up conversations between the generations about about love, about relationships, about like what did marriages look like when you were younger, and what do you believe is the role of sexual intimacy in a long-term relationship, and opening up these conversations between generations about what were the messages that you got and how are they different than the ones that I got. And there's so much insight, awareness, compassion that comes from these conversations that we are at tremendous risk of just not having. I'm struck by the number of students I teach who have not talked with their families about love, about sex, about marriage. And so I do a lot of things in my teaching and clinical work to push the envelope a little bit. Like, what if you just asked? What if you opened it up? So that's one piece of it, is just, I think generation gaps grow in silence.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because personally, I can never think of myself talking about love and intimacy with my family. And then I have a fiance whose mom was a therapist.
Yes,
and so then they talk through everything. And so it's just so interesting, like you hearing, you know, talking about intergenerational conversations, because there are so many different messages that have come through the generations. So very different perspectives.
Yes,
I will tell you that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. It's not that one is right and one is wrong.
Right.
But it's just, it's all of our work to think critically about the context we grew up in and carry through that which is working, and then transform that which isn't working. And we can transform patterns in our family without rejecting our family.
Yeah.
To live differently than we were raised to live is not a rejection. It's a carrying through. It's an evolution. So I think that sometimes scares my students, that if they start to question how their family talked or didn't talk about stuff, it feels disloyal. It feels rejecting. And it's so not. And so I always balance it against what did you love and appreciate about how you were raised? Because that, like holding on to that both and, I love and appreciate, and I'm transforming and shifting this.
Yeah. I wonder when we're really going to figure it out. If there's ever going to be a generation where it's like, yes, we nailed it. But then with technology and like the changing world.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. I always ask this question. And for you, it's a little bit more unique because you've been at Northwestern for most of your professional career, but how has the Northwestern Network, more broadly, I guess we can say, other alumni impacted your career? And maybe there are a few people that may stand out throughout your work in graduate school, at the Family Institute, and now as a professor, you know, you have so many different levels of your career at Northwestern. So how that impacted you?
Oh my gosh. It's like asking a fish to describe water. Like, I don't know any other way. But I mean, I am forever grateful for the education I got from Northwestern. My gosh, like the faculty that I was able to work with. Dan McAdams was the chair of my dissertation. He has been, I just had lunch with him not long ago, and just seeing him fills me with so much love and appreciation and gratitude for having been able to study with him as closely as I did. That's so extraordinary. Like, he's a huge force in our world. And the Family Institute was begun and run for many, many years by Bill Pinzoff, who is a founding father of the field of family therapy. And so to study directly with him as a graduate student, like, I look back and I think, he was my first supervisor. Like, a founder of the field of family therapy was my first clinical supervisor. Like, that's really extraordinary. And that would not have happened if I wasn't a Northwestern student. Like, it's just Northwestern brings to it incredibly excellent faculty who are committed to students, to mentorship. And I think that I feel awesome, like a responsibility to kind of be that then for students who are coming up, you know? And so I would never, ever say no to a student who wants to interview me for a paper or who wants to meet with me to talk about anything. I would never, ever say no to that because nobody ever said no to me on those things. You know, like there's, I think that's just the culture of Northwestern. It certainly is the culture of my two homes at Northwestern, the Family Institute, and then also the School of Education and Social Policy, which is where the Marriage 101 course lives. That's such a neat space on campus. Like, the way that they care for their students in a really wholehearted way, like not just their grades. In fact, a student was writing a paper about stress and anxiety on college campuses, and he asked me a question about how do you see Northwestern fostering competition between students? And I was like, I don't, and it just is not my, it's not my experience. I know it's an incredibly competitive place to get into. And I know there are lots expected, but I don't see faculty promoting competition between students. I see the faculty I interface with are all about promoting students, like just, yeah, you know, just promoting student learning. That was an interesting question, and one that I had a pretty hard time relating to.
Yeah. And speaking of questions, when I'm just so curious, when people find out the work that you do and the book you wrote, and what is the question you get the most from people?
Well, one that I get a lot is about my own marriage. I think that,
really? Oh, and I haven't even asked that.
Like,
oh.
Are you must be so good. Like, you must be so excellent, you know, as a spouse. And I have to be honest and say that my husband's, like, favorite, you know, he gets that question also. Like, what's it like to be married to this professor of love? His analogy he gives is that the best batting coaches are the worst hitters themselves.
Oh, no, he does not.
And there is, I mean, you were saying, like, I wonder when we're going to get it right, parenting the next generation. I have given up on the fact that I'm ever going to get it right all of the time as a spouse.
Yeah.
The best I do is screw up and shorten the time between realizing the screw up and making an apology for the screw up. Like, that's really been my growing edge, is that takes less time now from when I, like, put my foot in my mouth to when I can really offer a heartfelt apology and, like, return to the big picture. Like, I have lots of tools to do that now that I did not have when I was 22 and loving this same man, yeah, years and years ago.
That's like the key to a happy marriage, is yeah, realizing when you screw up and apologizing quickly.
That was an entire lesson in the book. And my husband's like, oh, really? Now show me how you're writing that chapter up, because that.
Definitely. And I feel like the communication piece has been another thing that's come up in other conversations throughout developing successful careers and developing successful relationships, is the communication between and helping each other realizing those screw ups. Because mm-hmm, sometimes you don't realize you put your foot. I don't know. That happens to me where I'm like, I didn't even realize I offended, yes, or messed up.
Totally. The framework there is intent versus impact. Mm. Like, we very rarely, I mean, those of us who intend to hurt people we love have got, you know, another sort of set of issues going on right there. But impact, we can hurt people even though we don't mean to or didn't even know that we did. And the only way we know that is when that person gives us feedback, like, hey, that hurt, or hey, that felt really insensitive. And so in the face of that feedback, the only question is, can we be brave enough and humble enough to be like, tell me more, like, help me understand that. I know that helps me, because my first knee-jerk is like, yeah, but I didn't mean to. Okay, so yeah, let's move past
that.
Yeah,
you know, yep,
you're not trying to hurt right, people you love, but you did.
Yeah. And, you know, how does your work and your perspective from the feminist perspective that you were talking about, how does that work, you know, when you're working with couples on communicating that they were hurt? Do you see that between the genders and how they communicate? Because I took a women's studies course in college, and something that really struck me was there's more difference amongst women than there is between women and men. And so there's such a gendered conversation. I don't know if maybe you can talk us through your perspective on working through these stereotypes, if right, you will.
Right. It's a perfectly timed question, because after I leave here, I'll go to the undergraduate course. And this week's topic is the impact of gender and sexuality on intimate relationships.
So well, perfect.
Kind of been.
There you go.
I have an Instagram that I curate and post on. And so today's post actually was also about the impact of gender conditioning and what happens, first of all, when we take billions of people and try to make them fit into one of two boxes, either a male box or a female box. That's one problem that mm-hmm, we don't. Gender is incredibly complicated, and yet we try to relegate everybody into either male or female. So that was sort of our first problem, is that we hold 0 degrees of complexity,
yep,
around gender. But it means also, when we only have two boxes, that we also heap tons of expectations of boys are and girls are. And I talked in my Instagram post about how a totally triggering phrase for me is when people, usually parents, say, oh, you're only, if somebody only has sons, they'll say something like, oh, you only have boys. Boys are so much easier. And that sends me through the roof, because boys and girls are incredibly emotionally complex, because humans are incredibly emotionally complex. But if you choose to socialize one gender to suppress any feeling besides maybe we let our boys be angry or happy, if you socialize them enough to associate tears, sadness, mm-hmm, fear, shame with being bad or being girly.
Weakness.
Yeah, weakness. Then, yeah, you probably can make them easier to raise because they don't exhibit any. Yeah, it's all suppressed until it comes out in rage or numbness or substance abuse or disconnection from self and other. So, yeah, I think it's incredibly problematic that we condition our boys this way. And then when people have been conditioned in the masculine come to therapy, it's like unpacking. I will work for years with people who've been conditioned in the masculine. It can take years to support them naming shame, just letting themselves feel it because it has been beat out of them that shame is weakness. And so when a relationship bridges a gender difference, when a relationship is a female-identified person partnering with a male-identified person, when that's a bridge, that's a cultural difference that has profound impact on communication, on how sex is expressed, negotiated, navigated, is profound. That always needs to be a piece of our conversation, is really appreciating how our gender role conditioning either constrains us in our – I mean, sometimes the message we get facilitate connection in our relationships, but a lot of the times gender ends up functioning like these little prisons, you know, where it limits us. A story I tell in Loving Bravely was a student a few years ago had like this aha moment where she's like, oh my God, this is like everything. She's like, I sometimes with my boyfriend – I love being the big spoon, and I love when he's the little spoon. Like, I love that position of having him be the little spoon and me be the big spoon. But when we do it, I, like, have this out-of-body experience, and I think, oh, my gosh, I'm being too manly, and he's being too girly. We can't do that. So even something about holding her partner the way she wants to, the way that feels intuitive to her, is constrained by a story she carries about gender and how that ought to work.
And I am just going to recognize, I don't know how to best ask this question, but in terms of gender playing out in same-sex relationships, the binary aspect that you were talking about being in two different boxes and then being in a same-sex relationship, how have you seen gender play out in same-sex relationships?
Yeah, absolutely it does. Because once we move past this idea that there are only two boxes, and we recognize actually that there are thousands of ways that even if you lined up five cis-identified women, you could sort of identify, well, her presentation is more feminine in this way, and her presentation is more masculine in this way. So there are ways in which we exhibit and express things that we have deemed masculine and things we have deemed feminine. So for a same-sex couple, they both might be living in cis male bodies, but this one has a more feminine expression around this aspect of self, and this one has a more feminine expression around this aspect of self. And then when they create a home together, oftentimes roles and responsibilities and power end up falling along lines that are very similar to how it looks when a mixed gender couple comes together in terms of the one with more income has more voice, the one who is more at home with kids carries more emotional labor. So all those kinds of things end up playing out in very similar ways as they do with mixed gender couples. Because our culture has really strong ideas about what we do around income and resource generation and caretaking of both the generation above and the generation below. So once a couple starts to divide those, you know, domestic jobs and those end up having impact on power and voice and access and privilege. And we can never talk about gender. The other thing I'll just say about this is we can never talk about gender without talking about how it intersects with all other aspects of identity, socioeconomic status, education level, race, ethnicity. So for our same-sex couples, we're always looking not just about gender and gender expression, but also how those intersect with the power dynamics that come from skin color and country of origin and education level.
Yeah, and first thought off that, it's interesting how we come full circle with income and your status in your career gives you a voice, more of a voice, not only at work, but in relationship. And also the podcast is called Northwestern Intersections. And tying it all in, when we were hashing out that name, the concept of intersectionality, which came out of, I believe, Black feminism.
Sure. Yep.
You know, that concept came up, like the way all of our identities come together really impacts our perspective on the world. And so it was just really interesting how that, you know, you're tying it all in, the Northwestern intersections and career and all of that. And I know you've done some really cool things throughout your career, wrote a book, and you're a professor and a clinical therapist. What are some of the things you're most proud of?
This is going to sound completely cheesy because we're doing a Northwestern podcast, but really one of my most favorite moments was when I was voted to do the last lecture at the end. So, I mean, everyone who's listening who is an alum knows, right, that the last lecture is senior week and they choose a faculty member to give a talk at, well, when I did it, it was at the Cubby Bear and this big crazy party, and it was such an honor. It was only a few years ago, so it still stands out really prominently. But I imagine down the road, I will still look back on it so fondly as just like a really cool recognition of, you know, the impact of what I love to do. So that was a highlight. I've had a couple of opportunities to go and present to the military at West Point Military Academy and at the Merchant Marine Academy. And that's a tremendous privilege to be able to speak. I'm brought in as part of a sexual assault prevention. And so I love that the work I do about love and connection and intimacy ends up being a way that we counter a culture of sexual assault and of violence. And so that's really meaningful when I have the chance to do that kind of work. It's special and feels really sacred and important to me.
Yeah, it's so interesting how you can have such a wide impact with your speaking engagements and kind of talking to so many different populations of people and your perspectives on the different generations and also different populations of peoples. And I know earlier you mentioned you don't really believe in mistakes. I always ask alumni when they come on the podcast if there have been any career missteps or lessons learned, you know, depending on how you interpret that, that you may want to share with the Northwestern Network.
I know. Yeah. So I really don't do the language of mistakes, although I mean, I certainly like trip and fall and like land on my face lots and lots of times, right, in my life in different ways. But I try to be sensitive about the language of mistakes because it, to me, ends up putting me in a place where I lose compassion for myself. So it's just not a particularly great place for me to go. But I would say that one of the ways this shows up for me is that so I am married to Todd, and we are raising kids together who are now teenagers. And I've been the point parent around, the sort of the primary parent. And that's a decision that, well, I mean, decision we made for all kinds of reasons that had to do with income and probably gender role conditioning as well. Yeah. So I've been the one who has shrunk back my career trajectory in order to make space for all of the intensity that comes from raising little people. And so there are times that I will look to the right and to the left and see what colleagues of mine have done and where they are in their career. And I'll start to get into this space of comparison of I haven't done enough and da-da-da. And so there are times that I can start to feel insecure about my path. And then I remember that there's incredible privilege around what I've been able to do in terms of having a foot in my career, even though it has been shrunk down at different times based on what our family system has needed. And there are things that I don't do and don't say yes to and can't say yes to because of my role within our family system. So I wouldn't call it a mistake, but it's a place where I know I need to hold compassion for myself. Because once I start to compare, well, if I hadn't done this, then maybe I'd be here, 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 and here by now. And so that's, in general, comparison is the killer of joy.
Yeah.
But I know that's a place that I can go and start to get myself into all kinds of twists and turns about what I've done with my career in order to raise kids.
Yeah, yeah, that's such a great thing to bring up, the comparison being such a killer of joy in personal life, professional life. It's so easy in this day and age to compare because of social media. Mm-hmm. And you see, and I have so many friends who, I'm just going to get off Facebook. All of my friends are getting married and having kids. It's just so easy to compare when that's your stream, that's your news feed. And so I think it's a constant struggle for obviously every generation, but particularly now with the social media, it makes it even more of a challenge. And you spoke earlier about some mentors in your life. And have you received any advice from any of these mentors or even in your personal life that's really stuck with you throughout your career?
Gosh, the one that I go to right away is a mentor of mine, Cheryl Rampage, who is at the Family Institute. And when I was pregnant with our first child, because we are a heterosexual couple, she said, make sure that you have time when your husband is fully in charge of the kids. Like, make sure that you set those expectations really early. You know, like another sort of triggering phrase for me is when people say that a dad is babysitting for his kids.
Oh my gosh.
I don't even know if we're still saying that, but I have heard it unfortunately far too recently. And so that was a really good piece of advice. So just make sure that I step away and really allow him to be in the driver's seat. I think part of what happens also is sometimes ambitious women become moms, and then they sort of take that ambition and put it towards their kids instead, and that can kind of create this need for control or desire for control that can make the other partner feel a little marginalized or they're just kind of riding along. So that was, I thought, a really good piece of advice. And then I think she also gave me a heads up about just how discontinuous a transition it is to go from a couple without kids to being a couple with a child. And I remember being pregnant and trying to have conversations with Todd about what we would do about the balance of work and family. And at some point, her saying, like, you don't even know what it's going to be yet. You can't make decisions based on information you don't have. You have no idea who you're going to be as a parent and who he's going to be as a parent. And so just that, like, again, trusting that you're going to figure it out as you go along. I say it often to our graduating seniors who want to figure out if they're going to try long distance with a partner or not try long distance. And I say to them, like, you don't even know yet what long distance feels like. So it's hard to expect of ourselves stuff that we don't even know yet how it's going to be.
Just on like a personal note, I feel like hearing you talk so openly about the decisions you made in your relationship, like you said, it gives me permission to make those considerations in my relationship. I'm getting married in a month, and you know, there's going to be a lot of things going on in our lives over the next several years, I'm sure. And I feel like just recently we got to a point where he's now making more money than me. And now I can, like, I just feel like now is the time when it's shifting that we have to consider income in career decisions and who's going to be point person on family. And we're in that shift. I just really appreciate you being so candid, especially with our alumni population, with those decisions, because I've been talking to so many people recently about family impacting careers. We did a webinar with Nikki Lively on the transition to parenthood. So she spoke a little bit about that, how it's so jolting. And we had so many alumni on the webinar grappling with, like, this is way different than I thought. And, you know, you anticipate one thing and it's completely different. And you're in a relationship, but now there's a child, and now how's that impacting your intimacy? And so we really appreciate you for sharing all of your insights with the Northwestern Network today. And I definitely want to give you, you know, some time if there's any other advice career-wise or relationship-wise that you want to share from your experiences with the Northwestern Network.
I mean, the biggest thing around relationship advice is just being willing to continually be a student of your partner and a student of your relationship, staying curious, staying humble. One of the really cool upsides of being in the information age is we have access to so many resources. There are amazing books out there and podcasts and webinars. And because it's such a highly romanticized culture, this idea of having to learn how to love and be loved well can feel really antithetical. If it takes work, it must be wrong and it must mean that we're not right for each other or you're not right for me or whatever. But instead, to flip that idea on its head and to know how to be successful in a romantic relationship, and that it's really worth learning, and it's worth learning together as a couple about what do we each need and how do we do this. That's a way of couples staying engaged with each other over time, and to be flexible with yourself and each other, and to know that career trajectories are long. They're long, and there's things that life is going to throw your way that you can't anticipate. And so to figure out how to let go of that fantasy that you can get it all right and that you can make a plan and you can execute the plan. Because the moment you have a really tight plan, the universe is like, oh, really? Okay, well, then try this. Like, see what happens when this comes your way, you know? And so to just be able to kind of flow with life is such an aspect of resilience. And it's so important for us to keep cultivating that, because it's not easy. It is a practice. I think our knee-jerk reaction is to kind of resist and say, no, I don't want this challenge in my life. And then to, like, okay, I'm going to breathe with it, and I'm going to eventually, what happens then, the more we breathe with it, is we open ourselves to, like, the growth that comes from the challenges that we face.
Thank you so much for all of the great feedback. I feel like I should come join you at your office hours that I know that you need to run off to. But it was really great spending this last hour with you. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Northwestern Intersections. To find more information about the podcast, please visit northwestern.edu/intersections. Have a great rest of your day, and go Cats.